Universität Hamburg.
Bodies and Subjectivities. The title is I'm a late 21st century techno crone, Bodies and Subjectivities in Cyberpunk. I'm going to start out to tell you a little bit about cyberpunk, as I wasn't sure this is not a science fiction conference, but fantastic, so it kind of incorporates all the areas. So I thought maybe I'll give a little introduction. It's a subgenre of science fiction. Cyberpunk offers a view of the future right around the corner. Globe-spanning corporations and heroic underground resistance to a successively aggressive, capitalist, and exploitative system are the usual ingredients in a cyberpunk novel. Reading and interpreting cyberpunk novels can offer insights into our own current situation in the Western world, where capitalism and techno-euphoria go hand in hand with annihilation anxieties, for instance, with biotechnology or genetics, which evokes lots of fears as well as euphoria. By looking at cyberpunk mythologies in relation to the current emergence of new cultural formations in and around cyberspace, we can investigate ideological dimensions of contemporary cyberculture. Particularly with a feminist agenda, it can prove useful to attend to the expressive practices of cyberpunk, to aim at a critical analysis of this specific socio-historic conjunction which we're experiencing right now, so to find out what's our world like at the moment. As every discourse, cyberpunk is produced within a specific cultural historical framework and is therefore a symbolic enactment of our cultural preoccupations, worries, and hopes. Therefore, looking at a cyberpunk novel not only tells us what our future might possibly look like by extrapolating current trends into the future, it can also bring into crystallized focus issues that are relevant today and demonstrate underlying fears. For instance, fears of the dissolvence of the boundaries between human and machine, or between the sexes, between male and female. And it can also demonstrate what established truths our society rests upon, as, for instance, the belief that we need firm and reliable boundaries between certain things. Might be one of those truths that our society still clings to. So when trying to understand and define cyberpunk and delineate its position within science fiction, it is most helpful to begin with Bruce Sterling's Manifesto, which is the 1986 preface to Mirror Shades, the cyberpunk anthology, which was edited by him. And without reiterating the common difficulties associated with defining genres and deciding who belongs and who doesn't and why and for what reason, I'm not going to go into that, I would just like to sketch the main features that features of cyberpunk that Sterling lists. He says it is a child of the 1980s, so very much a child of that time, and of traditional science fiction. It is in love with style and with a visionary concentration of images, which often result in a kind of sensory overload in the reader. And it mixes, I quote, the realm of high tech and the modern pop underground. This is kind of where the punk element comes in, end quote. Cyberpunk is specifically 1980s because this was the time of beginning globalization, the time when technology became visceral, when it's not distant, remote, and impressive anymore, so we don't have like these huge industrial things that represent technology, but now technology turns into the things that are a lot closer to us, they stick to our skin, they are sometimes even under our skin or in our minds. So this is kind of where technology is going, and that kind of started specifically in the 80s. And also the time of an urban streetwise subculture. And like I said, all of these aspects feature prominently in cyberpunk. Now, science fiction has always dealt with technology and its impact on humanity and on culture. So what is new about cyberpunk, Sterling claims, is that most of the authors actually now live in an extremely technologized world and have also grown up in this world. In a way, he claims that that was not the case before. And that, of course, influences their attitude towards technology. They are, as we are, immersed in technology, and at the same time, the careless technophilia of the past does not seem to be the right attitude anymore. It this technophilia seems to belong to a vanished and sluggish era when authorities still had a comfortable margin of control. And this feeling doesn't seem to fit anymore to the late 20th century or the 21st century, so this has changed. Sterling's vision of cyberpunk is shaped by his belief in its power of subversion and its attack on normalcy and on the socio-economic status quo, both of which, so this subversion is rooted in its hacker, rocker, punk attitude and mentality, and in its valorization of the socially marginalized. Whether or not this is all just a marketing hype, which Sterling and others have been accused of just turning cyberpunk into something that is really cool and punk and hip and creating it by just calling it that way, or whether this really has a political dimension to it and really a subversive dimension, has been hotly debated among several scholars. I would like to argue that without having to resort to an either-or decision and claiming it's always this or always that, one can definitely state that cyberpunk deals with issues of posthumanism, with questions of late capitalism and corporate power, with human-machine interactions that erode the common boundaries, with questions of reality and virtuality. And all these issues are relevant to our current Western media-saturated late capitalist society. So in that aspect, I think it certainly does have a political dimension to it. For these and other reasons, cyberpunk is often deemed the postmodern incarnation of science fiction. It's frequently called that. Science fiction, which usually, normally science fiction, favors a linear cause and effect story and a realist mode of narration, and cyberpunk kind of steps out of that. Cyberpunk does not depict the usual struggle of man against machine, of nature against culture, but, so it is often claimed, instead it breaks down this boundary, not having man here and machine there, but, and I go along with Veronica Hollinger here, who states in her article, Cybernetic Deconstructions, she says, we can read cyberpunk as an analysis of the postmodern identification of human and machine. So we don't have the struggle anymore, but we have the actual merging. There is no real difference anymore. Sorry. So Sterling stresses cyberpunk's emergence out of the tradition of science fiction. It is influenced by writers of the New Wave, such as Ellison, Delaney, Aldous, Ballard, as well as writers from the hard tradition, Stapleton, or Wells, or Heinlein. And it is always fond of visionaries such as Dick or Bester. And therefore, to him, cyberpunk has risen from within the SF genre. It's not an invasion, but a modern reform. That's what he claims. It has been pointed out by several critics that Sterling, as well as others dealing with the origins of cyberpunk, choose to ignore the mothers of cyberpunk. Namely, and particularly, the feminist science fiction writers of the 1970s, for whom an anti-humanist agenda is as central as for cyberpunk. So kind of both have the same aims in that area, even if from a very different angle. But still, this is an influence on cyberpunk that is just not pointed out by most critics. So as I said, both are post-humanist or anti-humanist in their attempt to destruct the coherent subject, which is grounded in the human body, and both wish to radically decenter the human body, the sacred icon of the essential self. The neglection of women authors in the construction of cyberpunk's history is not the only misogynistic attitude which we can find in cyberpunk. A large part of cyberpunk's appeal lies in its promise to get rid of the body, in its explorations of the pleasures of virtuality. And this, of course, reiterates the Cartesian mind-body split, and this mind-body split that promises transcendence only at the price of rejecting the body has long been exposed by misogynistic, in that women are equated much more with their bodies than men are, and in that way, through their biology, actually cannot reach the same transcendence that men can reach, and cannot reach full human status. Especially William Gibson's novel Neuromancer, which is frequently regarded as the quintessential cyberpunk novel, has been attacked for seeing in the body nothing else but meat, which to be gotten rid of as quickly as possible. But Cheryl Vint, in her book Bodies of Tomorrow, on the other hand, tries to restore the repressed body, as she says, to the text in her reading. And she wants to show that a more differentiated perception is possible, and that cyberpunk actually, I quote, interrogates embodied reality. So doesn't simply reject it and that's that, but actually asks the question, well, what does it mean to be embodied? What does it mean not to be embodied anymore? And where does that leave our sense of self, our identity? So far from simply glorifying the disembodied purity of existence in cyberspace, it puts this into question. Now I have a longer quote from Vint's book, Bodies of Tomorrow. She says, Gibson's novel articulates a particular type of subjectivity that is interested in repressing the body. So there is this idea to repress the body, and it suggests why this stance would be desirable. So that is attractive, to get rid of the body, because the subject wishes to sustain a construction of mastery, and the body undermines this construction. Our bodies always do strange things. They get sick or whatever, and we don't know how to trust them. So we can see why this might be attractive, to get rid of the body. But despite the appeal of this fantasy, the body in the novel is continually shown to be an inescapable part of cases, the protagonists, subjectivity, and the actual condition of being without a body is shown to be an absence of subjectivity. There's one character who does not have a body and who's not very happy about that and wants to be shut off in the end as well, because says that's not really a life. I would argue, along with Cheryl Vint, that cyberpunk's relation to the body is much more complex than, for instance, McCarran judges in his article Corpses, Animals, Machines and Mannequins. As he says, the interest cyberpunk writers take in the body is of a strictly negative kind, a kind which consistently affirms and even celebrates Cartesian dichotomy. So that is a very harsh judgment, and I think it's a lot more complex than that. Stirling's 1996 novel Holy Fire, which I want to talk about in a bit more detail now, puts the body right at the center of its explorations. And instead of aiming to get rid of the cumbersome body for an existence in cyberspace, the body in this novel is shown to be something inherently connected to subjectivity. Material existence, the sense of self, and technology, all these things, three things, are intertwined and interact in complex and dynamic fashion. The novel, in that way, participates in what Vint calls the critique of contemporary information culture, providing concrete examples of the risks inherent to life in the information age. Here, specifically, the dangers of surveillance, of medical tyranny, and of shaping our bodies to our personal needs. Since the novel is not very well known, I will give a very short summary of the plot. The main protagonist is Maya Zeman, and was born in 2001, and would therefore be already alive right now, and is now in the novel 94 years old. During the almost century of her life, things have changed quite a bit. Biomedicine is the dominating industry, and power is in the hands of wealthy senior citizens. The world is ruled by a global gerontocratic elite, the so-called polity. But wealth is not alone in this society, is not enough in this society. Your medical records are publicly available on the net. And if you do not do everything to maintain your health, then you will have a hard time doing business because people will not trust you. And you will not qualify for better medical procedures. So seemingly liberal, because alcohol and narcotics are not illegal, but any consumption thereof will of course show on your records, citizens are cursed into complying with the polity's needs for hardworking, responsible, trustworthy and self-sacrificing citizens who always have the best of the polity in mind. Among the medical techniques that are available in the late 21st century are different forms of life extension. And Maya, who has been living a cautious and sensible life and has taken meticulous care of her bodily health, qualifies for the most radical and new upgrade technology that will turn her into a 20-year-old again. So remember, she's 96 now and she will turn into a 20-year-old. But after the procedure, not only her body has been completely restructured, her identity has also changed. And casting off her old, careful, and conservative self, she tricks the medical personnel and runs off to Europe for fun and adventure. As we've seen, surveillance figures largely in the society at the end of the 21st century. What is considered to be private has changed significantly. Your health and your body certainly aren't. Instead of small talking about the weather, people now talk about their ailments and what kind of medical procedures they're going through. And other issues of your private life are equally open. One quote, Maya says, "Tell me about those two young people over there." Stuart stared at her, his monocle gleaming. "Are you kidding? What business is that of yours?" "Oh, I'm not asking you what networks they're accessing," Maya explained. "I just want to know a little bit about their personal lives." "Oh, okay, no problem," Stuart said, relieved. So your personal private life is not private, definitely. Besides the surveillance on the net, citizens are also observed within their own homes. Maya, for instance, has a cleaning woman coming twice a week to clean up and to check up on her. Quote, "Mercedes called her civil support work housekeeping, because that was a kindlier description than social worker, health inspector, or police spy," end of quote. But not only are people constantly monitored during their lives, even after death, the watchful eye does not rest, as can be seen in the description of Martin, who was a former lover of Maya, of Martin's funeral. I'm going to shorten that a little bit. It says, the scanner set to work, Martin's official medical imaging. Now all the scanners do all the research. And then they publicly nailed down the cause of death with utter cybernetic certainty. All the data was neatly and publicly filed on the net. So again, the surveillance is still there. And of course, Maya is told beforehand that her recovery process will entail even more detailed surveillance than is usual, since the procedure is so new. It's interesting to note here that the surveillance equipment for the recovery period, which Maya can examine on a previous patient, is compared to jewelry and other female accessories. Okay. A quote, a nude man appeared. He was festooned from head to foot in what seemed to be junk jewelry. A plastic coronet, earrings, false eyelashes, a little glued on breastplate, armlets, bracelets, 10 identical finger rings. A dozen adhesive patches on his torso, groin, and thighs, knee buckles, anklets, and shiny little toe rings. As we can see, these practices of surveillance produce what Foucault has termed docile bodies, individuals that are so preoccupied with monitoring their bodies and taking care of them that they are no threat to the established order. Foucault has never really addressed the gendered aspect of these docile bodies, something that he has been critiqued of. And similarly, I would argue, Sterling questions surveillance in his novel, but neither does he bring in the gender aspect, doesn't address the gender issue. So gender is seen as a natural given within the novel. Another aspect relating to gender is that womanhood in the novel is defined in close relation to sexuality, and both of these aspects are grounded in naturalness. So there's a natural sexuality and a natural womanhood. Yes, 1 minute, okay. On several occasions, Maya describes herself as beyond womanhood because she no longer has desires for a lover or a family. She says, I'm not a girl anymore. Nobody loves me, I don't love anyone, I don't hug anyone, I don't have sex, I don't have monthlies, I'm a post-sexual person, I'm a post-womanly person, and then I'm a late 21st century techno-crone. So here we can see how womanhood is automatically linked to sexuality or to a caring behavior.